flicked it at the glass eye of the totem pole. "You're right," I said. "If anything has happened to Geiger, I'll have to give what I have to the law, which puts it in the public domain and doesn't leave me anything to sell. So, with your permission, I'll just drift." His face whitened under the tan. He looked mean, fast, and tough for a moment. He made a movement to lift the gun. I added casually, "By the way, how is Mrs. Mars these days?" I thought for a moment I had kidded him a little too far. His hand jerked the gun, shaking. His face was stretched out by hard muscles.
"Beat it," he said quite softly. "I don't give a damn where you go or what you do when you get there. Only take a word of advice, soldier. Leave me out of your plans, or you'll wish your name was Murphy and you lived in Limerick."
"Well, that's not so far from Clonmel," I said. "I hear you had a pal came from there." He leaned down on the desk, frozen-eyed, unmoving. I went over to the door and opened it and looked back at him. His eyes had followed me, but his lean gray body had not moved. There was hate in his eyes. I went out and through the hedge and up the hill to my car and got into it. I turned it around and drove up over the crest. Nobody shot at me. After a few blocks, I turned off, cut the motor, and sat for a few moments. Nobody followed me either. I drove back into Hollywood. 14. It was 5:10 when I parked near the lobby entrance of the apartment house on Randall Place. A few windows were lit and radios were bleating at the dusk. I rode the automatic elevator up to the 4th floor and went along a wide hall carpeted in green and paneled in ivory. A cool breeze blew down the hall from the open screened door to the fire escape. There was a small ivory push button beside the door marked 405. I pushed it and waited what seemed a long time. Then the door opened noiselessly about a foot. There was a steady, furtive air in the way it opened. The man was long-legged, long-waisted, high-shouldered, and he had dark brown eyes in a brown, expressionless face that had learned to control its expressions long ago. Hair like steel wool grew far back on his head and gave him a great deal of domed brown forehead that might, at a careless glance, have seemed a dwelling place for brains. His somber eyes probed at me impersonally. His long, thin brown fingers held the edge of the door. He said nothing. I said, "Geiger?" Nothing in the man's face changed that I could see. He brought a cigarette from behind the door and tucked it between his lips and drew a little smoke from it. The smoke came towards me in a lazy, contemptuous puff, and behind it, words in a cool, unhurried voice that had no more inflection than the voice of a faro dealer.
"You said what?"
"Geiger. Arthur Gwynn Geiger. The guy that has the books." The man considered that without any haste. He glanced down at the tip of his cigarette. His other hand, the one that had been holding the door, dropped out of sight. His shoulder had a look as though his hidden hand might be making motions.
"Don't know anybody by that name," he said. "Does he live around here?"
I smiled. He didn't like the smile. His eyes got nasty. I said, "You're Joe Brody?" The brown face hardened.
"So what? Got a grift, brother? Or just amusing yourself?"
"So you're Joe Brody," I said, "and you don't know anybody named Geiger. That's very funny."
"Yeah? You got a funny sense of humor, maybe. Take it away and play on it somewhere else."
I leaned against the door and gave him a dreamy smile.
"You got the books, Joe. I got the sucker list. We ought to talk things over."
He didn't shift his eyes from my face. There was a faint sound in the room behind him, as though a metal curtain ring clicked lightly on a metal rod. He glanced sideways into the room. He opened the door wider.
"Why not, if you think you've got something?"
he said coolly. He stood aside from the door. I went past him into the room. It was a cheerful room with good furniture and not too much of it. French windows in the end wall opened on a stone porch and looked across the dusk at the foothills. Near the windows, a closed door in the west wall, and near the entrance door, another door in the same wall. This last had a plush curtain drawn across it on a thin brass rod below the lintel. That left the east wall, in which there were no doors. There was a davenport backed against the middle of it, so I sat down on the davenport. Brody shut the door and walked, crab-fashion, to a tall oak desk studded with square nails. A cedarwood box with gilt hinges lay on the lower leaf of the desk. He carried the box to an easy chair midway between the other two doors and sat down. I dropped my hat on the davenport and waited.
"Well, I'm listening,"
Brody said. He opened the cigar box and dropped his cigarette stub into a dish at his side. He put a long, thin cigar in his mouth.
"Cigar?"
He tossed one at me through the air. I reached for it. Brody took a gun out of the cigar box and pointed it at my nose. I looked at the gun. It was a Black Police 38. I had no argument against it at the moment.
"Neat, huh?"
Brody said.
"Just kind of stand up a minute. Come forward, just about 2 yards. You might grab a little air while you're doing that."
His voice was the elaborately casual voice of the tough guy in pictures. Pictures have made them all like that. I said, not moving at all. Such a lot of guns around town and so few brains. You're the second guy I've met within hours who seems to think a gat in the hand means a world by the tail. Put it down and don't be silly, Joe. His eyebrows came together and he pushed his chin at me. His eyes were mean. "The other guy's name is Eddie Mars," I said. "Ever heard of him?"
"No."
Brody kept the gun pointed at me. "If he ever gets wise to where you were last night in the rain, he'll wipe you off the way a check raiser wipes a check."
"What would I be to Eddie Mars?"
Brody asked coldly, but he lowered the gun to his knee. "Not even a memory," I said. We stared at each other. I didn't look at the pointed black slipper that showed under the plush curtain on the doorway to my left. Brody said quietly,
"Don't get me wrong. I'm not a tough guy. Just careful. I don't know hell's first whisper about you. You might be a life-taker for all I know."
"You're not careful enough," I said. "That play with Geiger's books was terrible." He drew a long, slow breath and let it out silently. Then he leaned back and crossed his long legs and held the Colt on his knee.
"Don't kid yourself, I won't use this heat if I have to," he said. "What's your story?"
"Have your friend with the pointed slippers come on in. She gets tired of holding her breath." Brody called out without moving his eyes off my stomach.
"Come on in, Agnes."
The curtain swung aside, and the green-eyed, thigh-swinging ash blonde from Geiger's store joined us in the room. She looked at me with a kind of mangled hatred. Her nostrils were pinched and her eyes had darkened a couple of shades. She looked very unhappy.
"I knew damn well you were trouble," she snapped at me. "I told Joe to watch his step."
"It's not his step. It's the back of his lap he ought to watch," I said.
"I suppose that's funny,"
the blonde said. "It has been," I said, "but it probably isn't any more."
"Save the gags,"
Brody advised me.
"Joe's watching his step plenty. Put some light on so I can see to pop this guy if it works out that way."
The blonde snicked on a light in a big square standing lamp. She sank down into a chair beside the lamp and sat stiffly, as if her girdle was too tight. I put my cigar in my mouth and bit the end off. Brody's Colt took a close interest in me while I got matches out and lit the cigar. I tasted the smoke and said, "The sucker list I spoke of is in code. I haven't cracked it yet, but there are about 500 names. You've got 12 boxes of books that I know of. You should have at least 500 books. There'll be a bunch more out on loan, but say 500 is the full crop, just to be cautious. If it's a good active list, and you could run it even 50% down the line, that would be 125,000 rentals. Your girlfriend knows all about that. I'm only guessing. Put the average rental as low as you like, but it won't be less than a dollar. That merchandise costs money. At a dollar a rental, you take 125 grand and you still have your capital. I mean, you still have Geiger's capital. That's enough to spot a guy for." The blonde said,
"You're crazy, you goddamn egg-headed."
Brody put his teeth sideways at her and snarled,
"Pipe down, for Christ's sake, pipe down."
She subsided into an outraged mixture of slow anguish and bottled fury, her silvery nails scraped on her knees. "It's no racket for bums," I told Brody almost affectionately. "It takes a smooth worker like you, Joe. You've got to get confidence and keep it. People who spend their money for second-hand sex jags are as nervous as dowagers who can't find the restroom. Personally, I think the blackmail angles are a big mistake. I'm for shedding all that and sticking to legitimate sales and rentals." Brody's dark brown stare moved up and down my face. His colt went on, hungering for my vital organs.
"You're a funny guy," he said tonelessly. "Who has this lovely racket?"
"You have," I said. "Almost." The blonde choked and clawed her ear. Brody didn't say anything. He just looked at me.
"What?"
the blonde called.
"You sit there and try to tell us Mr. Geiger ran that kind of business right down on the main drag? You're nuts."
I leered at her politely. "Sure I do. Everybody knows the racket exists. Hollywood's made to order for it. If a thing like that has to exist, then right out on the street is where all practical coppers want it to exist, for the same reason they favor red light districts. They know where to flush the game when they want to."
"My God," the blonde said. "You let this cheesehead sit there and insult me, Joe? You with a gun in your hand and him holding nothing but a cigar in his thumb?"
"I like it," Brody said. "The guy's got good ideas. Shut your trap and keep it shut, or I'll slap it shut for you with this."
He flicked the gun around in an increasingly negligent manner. The blonde gasped and turned her face to the wall. Brody looked at me and said cunningly,
"How have I got that lovely racket?"
"You shot Geiger to get it. Last night in the rain. It was dandy shooting weather. The trouble is, he wasn't alone when you whiffed him. Either you didn't notice that, which seems unlikely, or you got the wind up and lammed, but you had nerve enough to take the plate out of his camera, and you had nerve enough to come back later on and hide his corpse, so you could tidy up on the books before the law knew it had a murder to investigate."
"Yeah,"
Brody said contemptuously. The colt wobbled on his knee. His brown face was as hard as a piece of carved wood.
"You take chances, mister. It's kind of goddamn lucky for you I didn't bop Geiger."
"You can step off for it just the same," I told him cheerfully. "You're made to order for the rap." Brody's voice went rough.
"Think you got me framed for it?"
"Positive."
"How come?"
"There's somebody who'll tell it that way. I told you there was a witness. Don't go simple on me, Joe." He exploded then.
"That goddamn little hot pants!" he shouted. "She would, goddammer! She would, just that!"
I leaned back and grinned at him. "Swell, I thought you had those nude photos of her." He didn't say anything. The blonde didn't say anything. I let them chew on it. Brody's face cleared slowly with a sort of grayish relief. He put his colt down on the end table beside his chair but kept his right hand close to it. He knocked ash from his cigar on the carpet and stared at me with eyes that were a tight shine between narrowed lids.
"I guess you think I'm dumb,"
Brody said. "Just average for a grifter. Get the pictures."
"What pictures?"
I shook my head. "Wrong play, Joe. Innocence gets you nowhere. You were either there last night or you got the nude photo from somebody that was there. You know she was there because you had your girlfriend threaten Mrs. Regan with a police rap. The only ways you could know enough to do that would be by seeing what happened or by holding the photo and knowing where and when it was taken. Cough up and be sensible."
"I'd have to have a little dough,"
Brody said. He turned his head a little to look at the green-eyed blonde. Not now green-eyed and only superficially a blonde. She was as limp as a fresh-killed rabbit. "No dough," I said. He scowled bitterly.
"How'd you get to me?"
I flicked my wallet out and let him look at my buzzer. "I was working on Geiger for a client. I was outside last night in the rain. I heard the shots. I crashed in. I didn't see the killer. I saw everything else."
"And kept your lip buttoned,"
Brody sneered. I put my wallet away. "Yes," I admitted. "Up till now. Do I get the photos or not?"
"About these books," Brody said. "I don't get that."
"I tailed them here from Geiger's store. I have a witness."
"That punk kid?"
"What punk kid?" He scowled again.
"The kid that works at the store. He skipped out after the truck left. Agnes didn't even know where he flops."
"That helps," I said, grinning at him. "That angle worried me a little. Either of you ever been in Geiger's house before last night?"
"Not even last night," Brody said sharply. "So she says I gunned him, eh?"
"With the photos in hand, I might be able to convince her she was wrong. There was a little drinking being done."
Brody sighed. "She hates my guts. I bounced her out. I got paid, sure, but I'd have had to do it anyway. She's too screwy for a simple guy like me."
He cleared his throat.
"How about a little dough? I'm down to nickels. Agnes and me gotta move on."
"Not from my client."
"Listen,
get the pictures, Brody."
"Oh, hell," he said. "You win."
He stood up, and slipped the Colt into his side pocket. His left hand went up inside his coat. He was holding it there, his face twisted with disgust, when the door buzzer rang and kept on ringing. 15. He didn't like that. His lower lip went in under his teeth and his eyebrows drew down sharply at the corners. His whole face became sharp and foxy and mean. The buzzer kept up its song. I didn't like it either. If the visitors should happen to be Eddie Mars and his boys, I might get chilled off just for being there. If it was the police, I was caught with nothing to give them but a smile and a promise. And if it was some of Brody's friends, supposing he had any, they might turn out to be tougher than he was. The blonde didn't like it. She stood up in a surge and chipped at the air with one hand. Nerve tension made her face old and ugly. Watching me, Brody jerked a small drawer in the desk and picked a bone-handled automatic out of it. He held it at the blonde. She slid over to him and took it, shaking.
"Sit down next to him," Brody said. "Hold it on him low down away from the door. If he gets funny, use your own judgment. We ain't licked yet, baby."
"Oh, Joe,"
the blonde wailed. She came over and sat next to me on the davenport and pointed the gun at my leg artery. I didn't like the jerky look in her eyes. The door buzzer stopped humming, and a quick, impatient rapping on the wood followed it. Brody put his hand in his pocket on his gun and walked over to the door and opened it with his left hand. Carmen Sternwood pushed him back into the room by putting a little revolver against his lean brown lips. Brody backed away from her with his mouth working and an expression of panic on his face. Carmen shut the door behind her and looked neither at me nor at Agnes. She stalked Brody carefully, her tongue sticking out a little between her teeth. Brody took both hands out of his pockets and gestured placatingly at her. His eyebrows designed themselves into an odd assortment of curves and angles. Agnes turned the gun away from me and swung it at Carmen. I shot my hand out and closed my fingers down hard over her hand and jammed my thumb on the safety catch. It was already on. I kept it on. There was a short, silent tussle to which neither Brody nor Carmen paid any attention whatever. I had the gun. Agnes breathed deeply and shivered the whole length of her body. Carmen's face had a bony, scraped look, and her breath hissed. Her voice said, without tone,
"I want my pictures, Joe."
Brody swallowed and tried to grin.
"Sure, kid, sure."
He said it in a small, flat voice that was as much like the voice he had used to me as a scooter's is like a 10-ton truck. Carmen said,
"You shot Arthur Geiger. I saw you. I want my pictures."
Brody turned green. "Hey, wait a minute, Carmen," I called. Blonde Agnes came to life with a rush. She ducked her head and sank her teeth in my right hand. I made more noises and shook her off.
"Listen, kid," Brody said. "Listen a minute."
The blonde spat at me and threw herself on my leg and tried to bite that. I cracked her on the head with the gun, not very hard, and tried to stand up. She rolled down my legs and wrapped her arms around them. I fell back on the davenport. The blonde was strong with the madness of love or fear, or a mixture of both. Or maybe she was just strong. Brody grabbed for the little revolver that was so close to his face. He missed. The gun made a sharp rapping noise that was not very loud. The bullet broke glass in a folded back French window. Brody groaned horribly and fell down on the floor and jerked Carmen's feet from under her. She landed in a heap and the little revolver went skidding off into a corner. Brody jumped up on his knees and reached for his pocket. I hit Agnes on the head with less delicacy than before, kicked her off my feet and stood up. Brody flicked his eyes at me. I showed him the automatic. He stopped trying to get his hand into his pocket.
"Christ," he whined. "Don't let her kill me."
I began to laugh. I laughed like an idiot without control. Blonde Agnes was sitting up on the floor with her hands flat on the carpet and her mouth wide open and a wick of metallic blonde hair down over her right eye. Carmen was crawling on her hands and knees, still hissing. The metal of her little revolver glistened against the baseboard over in the corner. She crawled towards it relentlessly. I waved my share of the guns at Brody and said, "Stay put, you're all right." I stepped past the crawling girl and picked the gun up. She looked at me and began to giggle. I put her gun in my pocket and patted her on the back. "Get up, Angel, you look like a Pekingese." I went over to Brody and put the automatic against his midriff and reached his Colt out of his side pocket. I now had all the guns that had been exposed to view. I stuffed them into my pockets and held my hand out to him. "Give." He nodded, licking his lips, his eyes still scared. He took a fat envelope out of his breast pocket and gave it to me. There was a developed plate in the envelope and five glossy prints. Sure these are all? He nodded again. I put the envelope in my own breast pocket and turned away. Agnes was back on the Davenport, straightening her hair. Her eyes ate Carmen with a green distillation of hate. Carmen was up on her feet, too, coming towards me with her hand out, still giggling and hissing. There was a little froth at the corners of her mouth. Her small white teeth glinted close to her lips.
"Can I have them now?"
she asked me with a coy smile. "I'll take care of them for you. Go on home."
"Home?"
I went to the door and looked out. The cool night breeze was blowing peacefully down the hall. No excited neighbors hung out of doorways. A small gun had gone off and broken a pane of glass, but noises like that don't mean much anymore. I held the door open and jerked my head at Carmen. She came towards me, smiling uncertainly. "Go on home and wait for me," I said soothingly. She put her thumb up, then she nodded and slipped past me into the hall. She touched my cheek with her fingers as she went by.
"You'll take care of Carmen, won't you?"
she said. "Jack."
"You're cute."
"What you see is nothing," I said. "I've got a ballet dancing girl tattooed on my right thigh." Her eyes rounded. She said,
"Naughty,"
and wagged a finger at me. Then she whispered,
"Can I have my gun?"
"Not now. Later, I'll bring it to you." She grabbed me suddenly around the neck and kissed me on the mouth.
"I like you,"
she said.
"Carmen likes you a lot."
She ran off down the hall as gay as the thrush, waved at me from the stairs, and ran down the stairs out of my sight. I went back into Brody's apartment. 16. I went over to the folded back French window and looked at the small broken pane in the upper part of it. The bullet from Carmen's gun had smashed the glass like a blow. It had not made a hole. There was a small hole in the plaster which a keen eye would find quickly enough. I pulled the drapes over the broken pane and took Carmen's gun out of my pocket. It was a Banker Special, .22 caliber, hollow point cartridges. It had a pearl grip and a small round silver plate set into the butt was engraved, "Carmen from Owen." She made saps of all of them. I put the gun back in my pocket and sat down close to Brody and stared into his bleak brown eyes. A minute passed. The blonde adjusted her face by the aid of a pocket mirror. Brody fumbled around with a cigarette and jerked.
"Satisfied?"
"So far. Why did you put the bite on Mrs. Regan instead of the old man?"
"Tapped the old man once, about 6-7 months ago. I figured maybe he gets sore enough to call in some law."
"What made you think Mrs. Regan wouldn't tell him about it?" He considered that with some care, smoking his cigarette and keeping his eyes on my face. Finally he said,
"How well do you know her?"
"I've met her twice. You must know her a lot better to take a chance on that squeeze with the photo."
"She skates around plenty. I figure maybe she has a couple of soft spots she don't want the old man to know about. I figure she can raise $5,000 easy."
"A little weak," I said, "but pass it. You broke, eh?"
"I've been shaking 2 nickels together for a month trying to get them to mate."
"What do you do for a living?"
"Insurance. I got desk rooms in Puss Walgreen's office, Fullwider Building, Western and Santa Monica."
"When you open up, you open up. The book's here in your apartment?" He snapped his teeth and waved a brown hand. Confidence was oozing back into his manner.
"Hell no, in storage."
"You had a man bring them here, and then you had a storage outfit come and taken them away again right afterwards?"
"Sure. I don't want them moved direct from Geiger's place, do I?"
"You're smart," I said admiringly. "Anything incriminating in the joint right now?" He looked worried again. He shook his head sharply. "That's fine," I told him. I looked across at Agnes. She had finished fixing her face and was staring at the wall, blank-eyed, hardly listening. Her face had the drowsiness which strain and shock induce after their first incidents. Brody flicked his eyes warily.
"Well, how'd you come by the photo?"
He scowled.
"Listen. You got what you came after. Got it plenty cheap. You done a nice, neat job. Now go peddle it to your top man. I'm clean. I don't know nothing about any photo, do I, Agnes?"
The blonde opened her eyes and looked at him with vague but uncomplimentary speculation.
"Half-smart guy," she said with a tired sniff. "That's all I ever draw. Never once a guy that's smart all the way around the course. Never once."
I grinned at her. "Did I hurt your head much?"
"You and every other man I ever met."
I looked back at Brody. He was pinching his cigarette between his fingers with a sort of twitch. His hand seemed to be shaking a little. His brown poker face was still smooth. "We've got to agree on a story," I said. "For instance, Carmen wasn't here. That's very important. She wasn't here. That was a vision you saw."
"Huh," Brody sneered. "If you say so, pal. And if..."
He put his hand out palm up and cupped the fingers and rolled the thumb gently against the index and middle fingers. I nodded. "We'll see. There might be a small contribution. You won't count it in grands, though. Now, where did you get the picture?"
"The guy slipped it to me."
"Uh-huh. A guy you just passed in the street. You wouldn't know him again. You never saw him before." Brody yawned.
"It dropped out of his pocket,"
he said. "Uh-huh. Got an alibi for last night, Poker Pan?"
"Sure, I was right here. Agnes was with me. Okay, Agnes?"
"I'm beginning to feel sorry for you again," I said. His eyes flicked wide and his mouth hung loose, the cigarette balanced on his lower lip. "You think you're smart and you're so goddamn dumb," I told him. "Even if you don't dance off up in Quentin, you have such a bleak, long, lonely time ahead of you." His cigarette jerked and dropped ash on his waistcoat. "Thinking about how smart you are," I said.
"Take the air," he growled suddenly. "Dust. I got enough chinning with you. Beat it."
"Okay." I stood up and went over to the tall oak desk and took his two guns out of my pockets, laid them side by side on the blotter so that the barrels were exactly parallel. I reached my hat off the floor beside the Davenport and started for the door. Brody called.
"Hey!"
I turned and waited. His cigarette was jiggling like a doll on a coiled spring.
"Everything's smooth, ain't it?"
he asked. "Why, sure. This is a free country. You don't have to stay out of jail if you don't want to. That is, if you're a citizen. Are you a citizen?" He just stared at me, jiggling the cigarette. The blonde Agnes turned her head slowly and stared at me along the same level. Their glances contained almost the exact same blend of foxiness, doubt, and frustrated anger. Agnes reached her silvery nails up abruptly and yanked a hair out of her head and broke it between her fingers with a bitter jerk. Brody said tightly,
"You're not going to any cops, brother. Not if it's the Stern Woods you're working for. I've got too much stuff on that family. You got your pictures and you got your hush. Go and peddle your papers."
"Make your mind up," I said. "You told me to dust. I was on my way out. You hollered at me again and I stopped. And now I'm on my way out again. Is that what you want?"
"You ain't got anything on me," Brody said.
"Just a couple of murders. Small change in your circle." He didn't jump more than an inch, but it looked like a foot. The white cornea showed all around the tobacco-colored iris of his eyes. The brown skin of his face took on a greenish tinge in the lamplight. Blonde Agnes let out a low animal wail and buried her head in a cushion on the end of the Davenport. I stood there and admired the long line of her thighs. Brody moistened his lips slowly and said,
"Sit down, pal. Maybe I have a little more for you. What's that crack about two murders mean?"
I leaned against the door. "Where were you last night about 7:30, Joe?" His mouth drooped sulkily and he stared down at the floor.
"I was watching a guy. A guy who had a nice racket I figured he needed a partner in. Geiger. I was watching him now and then to see had he any tough connections. I figure he has friends or he don't work the racket as open as he does, but they don't go to his house, only dames."
"You didn't watch hard enough," I said. "Go on."
"I'm there last night on the street below Geiger's house. It's raining hard and I'm buttoned up in my coupe and I don't see anything. There's a car in front of Geiger's and another car a little way up the hill. That's why I stay down below. There's a big Buick parked down where I am, and after a while I go over and take a gander into it. It's registered to Vivian Regan. Nothing happens, so I scram. That's all."
He waved his cigarette. His eyes crawled up and down my face. "Could be," I said. "Know where that Buick is now?"
"Why would I?"
"In the sheriff's garage. It was lifted out of 12 feet of water off Lido Fish Pier this morning. There was a dead man in it. He had been sapped and the car pointed out the pier and the hand throttle pulled down." Brody was breathing hard. One of his feet tapped restlessly.
"Jesus, guy, you can't pin that one on me,"
he said thickly. "Why not? This Buick was down back of Geiger's, according to you. Well, Mrs. Regan didn't have it out. Her chauffeur, a lad named Owen Taylor, had it out. He went over to Geiger's place to have words with him because Owen Taylor was sweet on Carmen, and he didn't like the kind of games Geiger was playing with her. He let himself in the back way with a jimmy and a gun, and he caught Geiger taking a photo of Carmen without any clothes on. So his gun went off, as guns will, and Geiger fell down dead, and Owen ran away, but not without the photo negative Geiger had just taken. So you ran after him and took the photo from him. How else would you have got hold of it? Brody licked his lips.
Yeah,
he said.
But that don't make me knock him off.
Sure, I heard the shots and saw this killer come slamming down the back steps into the Buick and off. I took out after him. He hit the bottom of the canyon and went west on Sunset. Beyond Beverly Hills, he skidded off the road and had to stop, and I came up and played copper. He had a gun, but his nerve was bad, and I sapped him down. So I went through his clothes and found out who he was, and I lifted the plate holder, just out of curiosity. I was wondering what it was all about and getting my neck wet when he came out of it all of a sudden and knocked me off the car. He was out of sight when I picked myself up. That's the last I saw of him.
How did you know it was Geiger he shot? I asked gruffly. Brody shrugged.
I figure it was, but I can be wrong. When I had the plate developed and saw what was on it, I was pretty damn sure, and when Geiger didn't come down to the store this morning and didn't answer his phone, I was plenty sure. So I figure it's a good time to move his books out and make a quick touch on the Sternwoods for travel money and blow for a while.
I nodded. That seems reasonable. Maybe you didn't murder anybody at that. Where did you hide Geiger's body? He lifted his eyebrows, then he grinned.
Nix, skip it. You think I'd go back there and handle him, not knowing when a couple carloads of law would come tearing around the corner? Nix.
Somebody hit the body, I said. Brody shrugged. The grin stayed on his face. He didn't believe me. While he was still not believing me, the door buzzer started to ring again. Brody stood up sharply, hard-eyed. He glanced over at his guns on the desk.
"So she's back again," he growled.
"If she is, she doesn't have her gun," I comforted him. "Don't you have any other friends?"
"Just about one," he growled. "I got enough of this puss in the corner game."
He marched to the desk and took the Colt. He held it down at his side and went to the door. He put his left hand to the knob and twisted it and opened the door a foot and leaned into the opening, holding the gun tight against his thigh. A voice said,
"Brody?"
Brody said something I didn't hear. The two quick reports were muffled. The gun must have been pressed tight against Brody's body. He tilted forward against the door, and the weight of his body pushed it shut with a bang. He slid down the wood. His feet pushed the carpet away behind him. His left hand dropped off the knob, and the arm slapped the floor with a thud. His head was wedged against the door. He didn't move. The Colt clung to his right hand. I jumped across the room and rolled him enough to get the door open and crowd through. A woman peered out of a door almost opposite. Her face was full of fright, and she pointed along the hall with a claw-like hand. I raced down the hall and heard thumping feet going down the tile steps and went down after the sound. At the lobby level, the front door was closing itself quietly, and running feet slapped the pavement outside. I made the door before it was shut, clawed it open again, and charged out. A tall, hatless figure in a leather jerkin was running diagonally across the street between the parked cars. The figure turned, and flame spurted from it. Two heavy hammers hit the stucco wall beside me. The figure ran on, dodged between two cars, vanished. A man came up beside me and asked,
"What happened?"
"Shooting going on," I said.
"Jesus!"
He scuttled into the apartment house. I walked quickly down the pavement to my car and got in and started it. I pulled out from the curb and drove down the hill, not fast. No other car started up on the other side of the street. I thought I heard steps, but I wasn't sure about that. I rode down the hill a block and a half, turned at the intersection, and started to back up. The sound of a muted whistling came to me faintly along the pavement. Then steps. I double-parked and slid between two cars and went down low. I took Carmen's little revolver out of my pocket. The sound of the steps grew louder, and the whistling went on cheerfully. In a moment, the jerkin showed. I stepped out between the two cars and said, "Got a match, buddy?" The boy spun towards me, and his right hand darted up to go inside the jerkin. His eyes were a wet shine in the glow of the round electroliers. Moist, dark eyes, shaped like almonds, and a pallid, handsome face with wavy black hair growing low on the forehead in two points. A very handsome boy indeed. The boy from Geiger's store. He stood there looking at me silently, his right hand on the edge of the jerkin, but not inside it, yet. I held the little revolver down at my side.
"You must have thought a lot of that, Queen," I said.
go yourself,
the boy said softly, motionless between the parked cars and the 5-foot retaining wall on the inside of the pavement. A siren wailed distantly coming up the long hill. The boy's head jerked towards the sound. I stepped in close and put my gun into his jerkin. Me or the cops? I asked him. His head rolled a little sideways as if I'd slapped his face.
Who are you?
He said. Friend of Geiger's.
Get away from me, you son of a bitch.
This is a small gun, kid. I'll give it to you through the navel, and it'll take 3 months to get you well enough to walk, but you'll get well. So you can walk to the nice new gas chamber up at Quentin. He said,
go yourself.
His hand moved inside the jerkin. I pressed harder on his stomach. He let out a long, soft sigh, took his hand away from the jerkin, and let it fall limp at his side. His wide shoulders sagged.
What you want?
He whispered. I reached inside the jerkin and plucked out the automatic. Get into my car, kid. He stepped past me, and I crowded him from behind. He got into the car. Under the wheel, kid, you drive. He slid under the wheel, and I got into the car beside him. I said, let the prowl car pass up the hill. They'll think we moved over when we heard the siren. Then turn her downhill, and we'll go home. I put Carmen's gun away and leaned the automatic against the boy's ribs. I looked back through the window. The whine of the siren was very loud now. Two red lights swelled in the middle of the street. They grew larger and blended into one, and the car rushed by in a wild flurry of sound. Let's go, I said. The boy swung the car and started off down the hill. Let's go home, I said, to Laverne Terrace. His smooth lips twitched. He swung the car west on Franklin. You're a simple-minded lad. What's your name?
Carol Lundgren,
he said lifelessly. You shot the wrong guy, Carol. Joe Brody didn't kill your queen. He spoke 3 words to me and kept on driving. 17. A moon half gone from the full glowed through a ring of mist among the high branches of the eucalyptus trees on Laverne Terrace. A radio sounded loudly from a house low down the hill. The boy swung the car over to the box hedge in front of Geiger's house, killed the motor, and sat looking straight before him with both hands on the wheel. No light showed through Geiger's hedge. I said, anybody home, son?
You ought to know.
How would I know?
Go yourself.
That's how people get false teeth. He showed me his in a tight grin, then kicked the door open and got out. I scuttled out after him. He stood with his fists on his hips, looking silently at the house above the top of the hedge. All right, I said. You have a key. Let's go on in.
Who said I had a key?
Don't kid me, son. The fag gave you one. You've got a nice, clean, manly little room in there. He shooed you out and locked it up when he had lady visitors. He was like Caesar, a husband to women and a wife to men. Think I can't figure people like him and you out? I still held his automatic more or less pointed at him, but he swung on me just the same. It caught me flush on the chin. I backstepped fast enough to keep from falling, but I took plenty of the punch. It was meant to be a hard one, but a pansy has no iron in his bones, whatever he looks like. I threw the gun down at the kid's feet and said, maybe you need this. He stooped for it like a flash. There was nothing slow about his movements. I sank a fist in the side of his neck. He toppled over sideways, clawing for the gun and not reaching it. I picked it up again and threw it in the car. The boy came up on all fours, leering, with his eyes too wide open. He coughed and shook his head. You don't want to fight, I told him. You're giving away too much weight. He wanted to fight. He shot at me like a plane from a catapult, reaching for my knees in a diving tackle. I sidestepped and reached for his neck and took it into Chancery. He scraped the dirt hard and got his feet under him enough to use his hands on me where it hurt. I twisted him around and heaved him a little higher. I took hold of my right wrist with my left hand and turned my right hip bone into him, and for a moment it was a balance of weights. We seemed to hang there in the misty moonlight, two grotesque creatures whose feet scraped on the road and whose breath panted with effort. I had my right forearm against his windpipe now and all the strength of both arms in it. His feet began a frenetic shuffle, and he wasn't panting any more. He was iron-bound. His left foot sprawled off to one side, and the knee went slack. I held on half a minute longer. He sagged on my arm, an enormous weight I could hardly hold up. Then I let go. He sprawled at my feet, out cold. I went to the car and got a pair of handcuffs out of the glove compartment and twisted his wrists behind him and snapped them on. I lifted him by the armpits and managed to drag him in behind the hedge, out of sight from the street. I went back to the car and moved it 100 feet up the hill and locked it. He was still out when I got back. I unlocked the door, dragged him into the house, shut the door. He was beginning to gasp now. I switched a lamp on. His eyes fluttered open and focused on me slowly. I bent down, keeping out of the way of his knees, and said, "Keep quiet or you'll get the same and more of it. Just lie quiet and hold your breath. Hold it until you can't hold it any longer and then tell yourself that you have to breathe, that you're black in the face, that your eyeballs are popping out, and that you're going to breathe right now, but that you're sitting strapped in the chair in the clean little gas chamber up in San Quentin, and when you take that breath, you're fighting with all your soul not to take it. It won't be air you'll get. It will be cyanide fumes. And that's what they call humane execution in our state now."
"Go yourself," he said with a soft, stricken sigh.
"You're going to cop a plea, brother. Don't ever think you're not, and you're going to say just what we want you to say and nothing we don't want you to say."
"Go yourself."
"Say that again and I'll put a pillow under your head." His mouth twitched. I left him lying on the floor with his wrists shackled behind him and his cheek pressed into the rug and an animal brightness in his visible eye. I put on another lamp and stepped into the hallway at the back of the living room. Geiger's bedroom didn't seem to have been touched. I opened the door, not locked now, of the bedroom across the hall from it. There was a dim flickering light in the room and a smell of sandalwood. Two cones of incense ash stood side by side on a small brass tray on the bureau. The light came from the two tall black candles in the foot-high candlesticks. They were standing on straight-backed chairs, one on either side of the bed. Geiger lay on the bed. The two missing strips of Chinese tapestry made a St. Andrew's cross over the middle of his body, hiding the blood-smeared front of his Chinese coat. Below the cross, his black pajamaed legs lay stiff and straight. His feet were in the slippers with thick white felt soles. Above the cross, his arms were crossed at the wrists and his hands lay flat against his shoulders, palms down, fingers close together and stretched out evenly. His mouth was closed and his Charlie Chan mustache was as unreal as a toupee. His broad nose was pinched and white. His eyes were almost closed, but not entirely. The faint glitter of his glass eye caught the light and winked at me. I didn't touch him. I didn't go very near him. He would be as cold as ice and as stiff as a board. The black candles guttered in the draft from the open door. Drops of black wax crawled down their sides. The air of the room was poisonous and unreal. I went out and shut the door again and went back to the living room. The boy hadn't moved. I stood still, listening for sirens. It was all a question of how soon Agnes talked and what she said. If she talked about Geiger, the police would be there any minute. But she might not talk for hours. She might even have got away. I looked down at the boy. "Want to sit up, son?" He closed his eyes and pretended to go to sleep. I went over to the desk and scooped up the mulberry-colored phone and dialed Bernie Oles' office. He had left to go home at 6 o'clock. I dialed the number of his home. He was there. "This is Marlowe," I said. "Did your boys find a revolver on Owen Taylor this morning?" I could hear him clearing his throat, and then I could hear him trying to keep the surprise out of his voice. "That would come under the heading of police business," he said. "If they did, it had 3 empty shells in it."
"How the hell did you know that?"
Oles asked quietly. "Come over to 7244 Laverne Terrace off Laurel Canyon Boulevard. I'll show you where the slugs went." "Just like that, huh?" "Just like that." Oles said, "Look out the window and you'll see me coming round the corner. I thought you acted a little cagey on that one." "Cagey is no word for it," I said. 18. Oles stood looking down at the boy. The boy sat on the couch, leaning sideways against the wall. Oles looked at him silently, his pale eyebrows bristling and stiff and round like the little vegetable brushes the Fuller Brush Man gives away. He asked the boy, "Do you admit shooting Brody?" The boy said his favorite 3 words in a muffled voice. Oles sighed and looked at me. I said, "He doesn't have to admit that. I have his gun." Oles said, "I wish to Christ I had a dollar for every time I've had that said to me. What's funny about it?" It's not meant to be funny, I said.
Well, that's something, Ols said.
He turned away.
I've called Wilde. We'll go over and see him and take this punk. He can ride with me and you can follow on behind in case he tries to kick me in the face.
How do you like what's in the bedroom?
I like it fine, Ols said. I'm kind of glad the Taylor kid went off the pier. I'd hate to have to help send him to the death house for rubbing that skunk.
I went back into the small bedroom and blew out the black candles and let them smoke. When I got back to the living room, Ols had the boy up on his feet. The boy stood glaring at him with sharp black eyes and a face as hard and white as cold mutton fat.
Let's go, Ols said, and took him by the arms as if he didn't like touching him.
I put the lamps out and followed them out of the house. We got into our cars, and I followed Ols's twin tail lights down the long, curving hill. I hoped this would be my last trip to Laverne Terrace. Taggart Wilde, the district attorney, lived at the corner of 4th and Lafayette Park, in a white frame house the size of a car barn, with red sandstone porte-cochere built onto one side and a couple of acres of soft rolling lawn in front. It was one of those solid, old-fashioned houses, which it used to be the thing to move bodily to new locations as the city grew westward. Wilde came of an old Los Angeles family and had probably been born in the house when it was on West Adams or Figueroa or St. James's Park. There were two cars in the driveway already, a big private sedan and a police car with a uniformed chauffeur who leaned smoking against his rear fender and admiring the moon. Ols went over and spoke to him, and the chauffeur looked in at the boy in Ols's car. We went up to the house and rang the bell. A slick-haired blonde man opened the door and led us down the hall and through a huge sunken living room crowded with heavy, dark furniture and along another hall on the far side of it. He knocked at a door and stepped inside, then held the door wide, and we went into a paneled study with an open French door at the end and a view of dark garden and mysterious trees. A smell of wet earth and flowers came in at the window. There were large dim oils on the walls, easy chairs, books, a smell of good cigar smoke which blended with the smell of wet earth and flowers. Taggart Wilde sat behind a desk, a middle-aged plump man with clear blue eyes that managed to have a friendly expression without really having any expression at all. He had a cup of black coffee in front of him and he held a dappled thin cigar between the neat, careful fingers of his left hand. Another man sat at the corner of the desk in a blue leather chair, a cold-eyed, hatchet-faced man, as lean as a rake and as hard as the manager of a loan office. His neat, well-kept face looked as if it had been shaved within the hour. He wore a well-pressed brown suit, and there was a black pearl in his tie. He had the long, nervous fingers of a man with a quick brain. He looked ready for a fight. Ols pulled a chair up and sat down and said,
"Evening, Cronjager. Meet Phil Marlowe, a private eye who's in a jam."
Ols grinned. Cronjager looked at me without nodding. He looked me over as if he was looking at a photograph. Then he nodded his chin about an inch. Wilde said,
"Sit down, Marlowe. I'll try to handle Captain Cronjager, but you know how it is. This is a big city now."
I sat down and lit a cigarette. Ols looked at Cronjager and asked,
"What did you get on the Randall Place killing?"
The hatchet-faced man pulled one of his fingers until the knuckle cracked. He spoke without looking up.
Stiff. Two slugs in him. Two guns that hadn't been fired. Down on the street we got a blonde trying to start a car that didn't belong to her. Hers was right next to it. The same model. She acted rattled, so the boys brought her in and she spilled. She was in there when this guy Brody got it. Claims she didn't see the killer."
"That all?" Ols asked. Cronjager raised his eyebrows a little.
"Only happened about an hour ago. What did you expect, moving pictures of the killing?"
"Maybe a description of the killer," Ols said.
"A tall guy in a leather jerkin, if you call that a description."
"He's outside in my heap," Ols said, "handcuffed. Marlowe put the arm on him for you. Here's his gun." Ols took the boy's automatic out of his pocket and laid it on a corner of Wilde's desk. Cronjager looked at the gun, but didn't reach for it. Wilde chuckled. He was leaning back and puffing his dappled cigar without letting go of it. He bent forward to sip from his coffee cup. He took a silk handkerchief from the breast pocket of the dinner jacket he was wearing and touched his lips with it and tucked it away again.
"There's a couple more deaths involved," Ols said, pinching the soft flesh at the end of his chin.
Cronjager stiffened visibly. His surly eyes became points of steely light. Ols said,
You heard about a car being lifted out of the Pacific Ocean off Lido Pier this morning with a dead guy in it?
Cronjager said, no, and kept on looking nasty.
The dead guy in the car was chauffeur to a rich family,
Ulz said.
The family was being blackmailed on account of one of the daughters. Mr. Wilde recommended Marlowe to the family, through me. Marlowe played it kind of close to the waistcoat.
I love private dicks that play murders close to the waistcoat, Cronjager said. You don't have to be so goddamned coy about it.
Yeah, Ulz said. I don't have to be so goddamned coy about it. It's not so goddamned often I get a chance to be coy with a city copper. I spend most of my time telling them where to put their feet so they won't break an ankle.
Cronjager whitened around the corners of his sharp nose. His breath made a soft hissing sound in the quiet room. He said very quietly,
You haven't had to tell any of my men where to put their feet, smart guy.
We'll see about that, Ulz said. This chauffeur I spoke of that's drowned off Lido shot a guy last night in your territory. A guy named Geiger, who ran a dirty book racket in a store on Hollywood Boulevard. Geiger was living with the punk I got outside in my car. I mean, living with him, if you get the idea.
Cronjager was staring at him levelly now.
That sounds like it might grow up to be a dirty story, he said.
It's my experience most police stories are,
Ulz growled and turned to me, his eyebrows bristling.
You're on the air, Marlowe. Give it to him.
I gave it to him. I left out two things, not knowing just why at the moment. I left out one of them. I left out Carmen's visit to Brody's apartment and Eddie Mars's visit to Geiger's in the afternoon. I told the rest of it just as it happened. Cronjager never took his eyes off my face, and no expression of any kind crossed his as I talked. At the end of it, he was perfectly silent for a long minute. Wilde was silent, sipping his coffee, puffing gently at his dappled cigar. Ulz stared at one of his thumbs. Cronjager leaned slowly back in his chair and crossed one ankle over his knee and rubbed the ankle bone with his thin, nervous hand. His lean face wore a harsh frown. He said with deadly politeness,
So all you did was not report a murder that happened last night, and then spend today foxing around so that this kid of Geiger's could commit a second murder this evening.
That's all, I said. I was in a pretty tough spot. I guess I did wrong, but I wanted to protect my client, and I hadn't any reason to think the boy would go gunning for Brody.
That kind of thinking is police business, Marlowe. If Geiger's death had been reported last night, the books could never have been moved from the store to Brody's apartment. The kid wouldn't have been led to Brody and wouldn't have killed him. Say Brody was living on borrowed time, his kind usually are, but a life is a life.
Right, I said. Tell that to your coppers next time they shoot down some scared petty larceny crook running away up an alley with a stolen spare. Wilde put his hands down on his desk with a solid smack.
That's enough of that, he snapped. What makes you so sure, Marlowe, that this Taylor boy shot Geiger? Even if the gun that killed Geiger was found on Taylor's body or in the car, it doesn't absolutely follow that he was the killer. The gun might have been planted, say by Brody, the actual killer.
It's physically possible, I said, but morally impossible. It assumes too much coincidence and too much that's out of character for Brody and his girl, and out of character for what he was trying to do. I talked to Brody for a long time. He was a crook, but not a killer type. He had two guns, but he wasn't wearing either of them. He was trying to find a way to cut in on Geiger's racket, which naturally he knew all about from the girl. He says he was watching Geiger off and on to see if he had any tough backers. I believe him. To suppose he killed Geiger in order to get his books, then scrammed with the nude photo Geiger had just taken of Carmen Sternwood, then planted the gun on Owen Taylor and pushed Taylor into the ocean off Lido, is to suppose a hell of a lot too much. Taylor had the motive, jealous rage, and the opportunity to kill Geiger. He was out in one of the family cars without permission. He killed Geiger right in front of the girl, which Brody would never have done, even if he had been a killer. I can't see anybody with a purely commercial interest in Geiger doing that, but Taylor would have done it. The nude photo business was just what would have made him do it. Wilde chuckled and looked along his eyes at Cronjager. Cronjager cleared his throat with a snort. Wilde asked,
What's this business about hiding the body? I don't see the point of that.
I said, The kid hasn't told us, but he must have done it. Brody wouldn't have gone into the house after Geiger was shot. The boy must have got home when I was away taking Carmen to her house. He was afraid of the police, of course, being what he is, and he probably thought it a good idea to have the body hidden until he had removed his effects from the house. He dragged it out of the front door, judging by the marks on the rug, and very likely put it in the garage. Then he packed up whatever belongings he had there and took them away. And later on, sometime in the night, and before the body stiffened, he had a revulsion of feeling and thought he hadn't treated his dead friend very nicely. So he went back and laid him out on the bed. That's all guessing, of course. Wilde nodded.
Then this morning he goes down to the store as if nothing had happened and keeps his eyes open, and when Brody moved the books out, he found out where they were going and assumed that whoever got them had killed Geiger just for that purpose. He may even have known more about Brody and the girl than they suspected. What do you think, Oles?
Oles said, "We'll find out, but that doesn't help Cronjager's troubles. What's eating him is all this happened last night, and he's only just been rung in on it."
Cronjager said sourly,
"I think I can find some way to deal with that angle, too."
He looked at me sharply and immediately looked away again. Wilde waved his cigar and said,
"Let's see the exhibits, Marlowe."
I emptied my pockets and put the catch on his desk, the three notes and Geiger's card to General Sternwood, Carmen's photos, and the blue notebook with the code list of names and addresses. I had already given Geiger's keys to Oles. Wilde looked at what I gave him, puffing gently at his cigar. Oles lit one of his own toy cigars and blew smoke peacefully at the ceiling. Cronjager leaned on the desk and looked at what I had given Wilde. Wilde tapped the three notes signed by Carmen and said,
"I guess these were just to come on. If General Sternwood paid them, it would be through fear of something worse. Then Geiger would have tightened the screws. Do you know what he was afraid of?"
He was looking at me. I shook my head.
"Have you told your story complete in all relevant details?"
"I left out a couple of personal matters. I intend to keep on leaving them out, Mr. Wilde." Cronjager said,
"Huh,"
and snorted with deep feeling.
"Why?"
Wilde asked quietly.
"Because my client is entitled to that protection, short of anything but a grand jury. I have a license to operate as a private detective. I suppose that word private has some meaning. The Hollywood Division has two murders on its hands, both solved. They have both killers. They have the motive, the instrument in each case. The blackmail angle has got to be suppressed as far as the names of the parties are concerned."
"Why?"
Wilde asked again.
"That's okay," Cronjager said dryly. "We're glad to stooge for a Seamus of his standing."
I said, "I'll show you." I got up and went back out of the house to my car and got the book from Geiger's store out of it. The uniformed police driver was standing beside Oles's car. The boy was inside it, leaning back sideways in the corner.
"Has he said anything?" I asked.
"He made a suggestion," the copper said and spat. "I'm letting it ride."
I went back into the house, put the book on Wilde's desk, and opened up the wrappings. Cronjager was using a telephone on the end of the desk. He hung up and sat down as I came in. Wilde looked through the book, wooden-faced, closed it and pushed it towards Cronjager. Cronjager opened it, looked at a page or two, shut it quickly. A couple of red spots the size of half dollars showed on his cheekbones. I said, "Look at the stamped dates on the front end paper." Cronjager opened the book again and looked at them.
"Well?"
"If necessary," I said, "I'll testify under oath that that book came from Geiger's store. The blonde, Agnes, will admit what kind of business the store did. It's obvious to anybody with eyes that that store is just a front for something. But the Hollywood police allowed it to operate for their own reasons. I dare say the grand jury would like to know what those reasons are."
Wilde grinned.
He said,
"Grand juries do ask those embarrassing questions sometimes, in a rather vain effort to find out just why cities are run as they are run."
Cronjager stood up suddenly and put his hat on.
"I'm one against three here," he snapped. "I'm a homicide man. If this Geiger was running indecent literature, that's no skin off my nose. But I'm ready to admit it won't help my division any to have it washed over in the papers. What do you birds want?"
Wilde looked at Oles. Oles said calmly,
"I want to turn a prisoner over to you. Let's go."
He stood up. Cronjager looked at him fiercely and stalked out of the room. Oles went after him. The door closed again. Wilde tapped on his desk and stared at me with his clear blue eyes.
"You ought to understand how any copper would feel about a cover-up like this," he said. You'll have to make statements of all of it, at least for the files. I think it may be possible to keep the two killings separate and to keep General Sternwood's name out of both of them. Do you know why I'm not tearing your ear off?
No, I expected to get both ears torn off.
What are you getting for it all? $25 a day.